This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
The Rabble Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Show your support by going to rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
BC and Canadian mining companies have a poor human rights record outside the country. And not all developing countries have a court system set up to adequately protect the rights of workers. Seven men from Guatemala are trying to sue Tahoe Resources, a BC company with mining operations around the world. Last month, the BC Court of Appeal said that the Guatemalan lawsuit can go ahead in the British Columbia courts. Raider Morgerman is a partner with the law firm CFM. That firm, along with the Canadian Centre for International Justice, have been supporting the seven Guatemalans in their suit against Tahoe Resources. Raider Morgerman joins me on the phone. Hello, Raider.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Can you start by telling us what happened in Guatemala between these men and Tahoe Resources, which precipitated this lawsuit?
Yeah, so the sort of immediate precipitating event was these men were protesting in a peaceful protest outside the gates of the mine in Guatemala, and the mine security personnel essentially opened fire on them at close range as the men were walking away and then eventually running away from the security officers. So that was the immediate precipitating event, was mine security shooting peaceful protesters.
And what was it that the men were protesting in the first place?
Yeah, so the mine is a very controversial mine, as is often the case, and crystallizes sort of a dispute or a tension between the local either indigenous people or the people who are farmers in the area and the commercial interests that want the mine to go ahead. And so there's significant controversy about the potential environmental implications of the mine, the potential economic and cultural implications of the mine. And so these people are standing against that. And that is the sort of the broader context in which that narrow event precipitated out of.
So what are these men, what precisely are they suing Tahoe Resources for?
So they're suing Tahoe for sort of, I'll put it into two broad categories. The one broad category is what you'd think of as a traditional Canadian tort case. So battery, assault. If you injure somebody in that intentional way, they get to sue you and collect damages for that. The broader context of the lawsuit, though, is that it has a real human rights quality to it, because what's going on here is that these people need the right to protest. They need the right to engage in this sort of activity. And in Guatemala, unfortunately, in this case, the power structure is lined up against this kind of protest. And so you have both the narrow lawsuit that says, you shot me and you owe me damages, or you injured me and you owe me damages, and then the broader lawsuit that says, it's a human rights issue that I'd be able to do this, and it's a human rights issue for you to try and suppress peaceful protest in this way.
Before we go any further, can you tell us a little bit more about Tahoe Resources?
So this is a Canadian owned mining company. So if you go to the top of the corporate chain, you find a Canadian company, and then it has subsidiaries that are sort of what you call sort of corporate organization subsidiaries. But its big asset and its wholly owned big asset is this mine in Guatemala, which is a silver mine. So you have a Canadian parent, essentially, with a Guatemalan sub, and that subsidiary is wholly owned. So you basically have a closed loop. And the only other companies in the mix are, I'll call them kind of legal or tax planning companies, but they're not substantively changing the relationship between the parent and sub, which is basically hand in glove.
Now, why did the Guatemalan men seek to sue Tahoe Resources here in BC rather than down in Guatemala?
Right. So again, there are a number of parts to the answer. I'll start with Tahoe, the parent, the ultimately responsible party, the party that said it would respect human rights, and the party we say didn't respect human rights, is here. So there's one level where we say, look, if you're a Canadian company and you raise money in the Canadian markets and you take advantage of the Canadian system, then the Canadian courts are going to supervise you. There is also in this case, and it's unfortunate that it is in this and other cases, there is a real risk that the Guatemalan legal system isn't able to provide a fair trial to these people because of the nature of the issues, because of the politics and economics around the mine. So there's a real concern, and there was some powerful evidence on this point, but there was a real concern that these people couldn't get a fair trial because of the way the power structure works in Guatemala.
What precisely did the BC Court of Appeal decide last week?
Right, so the BC Court of Appeal reversed a lower court decision, and the nub of the BC Court of Appeal's decision is that the Canadian courts will exercise the jurisdiction that they have over Tahoe, and the trial can take place in British Columbia. So the lower court had said that it would be clearly more convenient for the case to take place in Guatemala, and that essentially would essentially end the case, because if Canada wasn't going to do it, the Guatemalan system wasn't up to it, and the case would simply not proceed. So what the British Columbia Court of Appeal did was it said the British Columbia courts have both the jurisdiction over Tahoe, but also will exercise their jurisdiction and will have the trial in British Columbia.
And what convinced the Court of Appeal to rule in favor of the Guatemalan men? Was it only the state of the Guatemalan court system?
No. So the test. The test has a bunch of elements in it, and it's really an exercise of discretion. And what the court is trying to figure out is it clearly more convenient to send this case to another court? And the reason the lower court found that it was clearly more convenient was a bunch of factors, like where the people are, where they live, where the evidence is, what is the nature of the Guatemalan system. So what the British Columbia, I'm getting a long route to a short answer, what the British Columbia Court of Appeal said was there are a number of elements that connect this case to British Columbia, making it convenient to have the case heard here. And there was a very important element that had changed between the two decisions, and that was the head of mine security, a guy named Rotundo, had been under house arrest. Interestingly, his phones were tapped for other reasons. So he was caught on tape describing what he was going to do to the protesters, and then also describing what happened in the aftermath of the shooting. He was arrested, and the lower court found that because he was arrested and he was being prosecuted, that was an element of Guatemalan justice that made it convenient to have the case heard in Guatemala. And then in the interim, he escaped from house arrest and fled to his native Peru and raised his finger at the Guatemalan system and said, I'm not coming back. And so the Court of Appeal was faced with a situation where one of the core elements that the lower court had relied on had changed, that the person who was going to be prosecuted, it didn't look like was actually going to be prosecuted. And the circumstances of his escape are allegedly quite interesting. It's alleged that the police may have assisted in his escape. So you had a fact that moved, and then you had the court take a different legal approach and say, look, Canada is the place we're going to have these cases heard if there's a real risk of an unfair trial in the other jurisdiction.
Is this a decision, is this something new for Canadian jurisdiction? Have companies been able to, or people rather, been able to successfully sue Canadian companies before?
The answer is yes and no. So it is new in the sense that there have not been a lot of these cases that have moved forward procedurally in the past. I think some positive examples were the Hud Bay case in Ontario. There's a case against Nevsun that we have on behalf of people who were essentially conscript or slave labor, allegedly, in a Nevsun mine in Eritrea. So there have been some examples of courts being willing to do this. And there's a history of this. There are a bunch of English cases going back, to examples where the courts were not willing to send people back to Nazi Germany to have cases that, on normal rules, you think should go to Germany in that era. The court said, we're not going to send them there. We'll try them here because it's the only place to do it. So, again, that was a long way of saying it's not without precedent, but it is important. And it's important not just in the broad sense, it's important for these people in this case. But, the lawyer in me says it's not that exceptional. If you just apply the rules, a fair and proper application of the rules was the court taking jurisdiction. So it's not exceptional in that sense, but it is exceptional because it is very difficult in the power imbalance that you have in these kinds of cases or a bunch of farmers who are shot in front of a mine in Guatemala to have their case constructed and heard and litigated in British Columbia. So that's a big step. It's an important step.
What sort of influence is this decision likely to have on other similar cases that are going on in Canada?
Yeah, so I think, as I said, in part, this is just a statement of a test that's been around for a long time. But in part, it's an important precedent. I can't shy away from the fact that it is an important precedent. The court looked at this test and said, where we have a real risk of unfairness in another country, we're not going to send the case there. Again, that seems like common sense to the man and woman on the city bus. But it's not automatic for the law to do that. So it's a really important statement for them to say that. And for example, in the Nevsun case, the Court of Appeals decision will be an important legal precedent that structures how we approach jurisdiction in the Nevsun case. So it's important in that sense, but it's not it's not, and it shouldn't be revolutionary. It's the law going in the right direction.
Now, with this appeal decision, does this mean the case is going to finally go forward, or do Tahoe have another appeal or two left in him?
We'll step in the jurisdiction skirmish, and that is that Tahoe has the option to seek leave to ask the Supreme Court of Canada to hear the case, and they have to think through whether they want that. Even if you get leave to the Supreme Court of Canada, if you're Tahoe, it's a risky thing to do because you could have a bigger, more influential, more a court with an even broader say imposing these rules on you, which could be quite difficult for them. So they've got a strategic decision to make. They have to figure out whether they want to seek leave to appeal, and if they ask the Supreme Court of Canada, the Supreme Court of Canada has to grant them leave, and that again is not automatic. So there's still a bunch of procedural wrangling that has to go on. But this grounds the case in BC, and we're going to be pushing the case forward in BC, and Tahoe has a decision to make, basically.
So assuming all the appeals are exhausted and we go ahead with this trial, what then would likely happen?
Yeah, so then you actually have another set of interesting, important legal issues that I think are playing out in cases like Hud Bay or in the Chevron case, and those issues really turn on when is the parent company that's in the developed wealthy world going to be responsible for the extraction that it does in the developing and less wealthy world? And our legal system creates these independent corporate identities, and they're important to our legal system, but they can be and sometimes are used to shield the ultimately and appropriately responsible person from liability. So there's going to be a big, there is a big fight that's playing out in Canadian law and indeed in England and around the world, where people are starting to ask the question, what are the limits of these old corporate legal structures? How far can we look through them? And Tahoe will be a case in which that plays out. We will try and hold Tahoe responsible, and they will say, look, it was our subsidiary that did it. It wasn't us. And we think we have very powerful arguments for why that's not the case, but there will ultimately be a trial about that. That's what Tahoe will say, I would imagine. I mean, I don't know. But that's my guess.
Well, it is indeed a very important story, and I thank you very much for taking the time and speaking with us about it.
No problem. Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Radar Mogerman. He is a partner in the law firm Camp Fiorente Matthews Mogerman. That firm, along with the Canadian Center for International Justice, have been supporting 7 Guatemalan men in their suit against Tahoe Resources. To learn more about the case, you can go to the Canadian Center for International Justice website, ccij.ca.